For winning his first professional fight, Joe Louis earned $59. That was in July 1934. Over the next 15 years, he won a great many fights and earned tens of millions of dollars, much of it for people other than himself. More significantly, he became a hero, first to black citizens in the U.S. and then to everyone who needed a surrogate champion to battle the idea of fascism as it had taken hold in Germany. In his new biography of Joe Louis, Randy Roberts explores the mythical status Louis achieved and contrasts it with the reality of the sometimes less than heroic circumstances of his life. Randy Roberts joins me now from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Joe Louis found his way into the ring by accident when an amateur boxer, Thurston McKinney, needed a sparring partner. How did that session go?
It didn't go well for Joe at first, but all of a sudden, then Joe connected with a right hand and knocked Thurston down, and Thurston was, he was virtually out on his feet. And Joe Louis discovered that he can hit people really hard. And when he lands a punch, they stay hit.
It's interesting that Thurston McKinney, his first opponent, knew that Louis was taking violin lessons, and his advice was, put that violin away.
The age of the violin ended. He was never much of a violin player. If he had stayed with the violin, I don't think we would have ever heard of Joe Louis.
Years before anybody had heard of Joe Louis, Jack Johnson had proved that a black man could become heavyweight champion of the world. How did it happen that Louis came to assume such symbolic importance for black Americans?
This is an age where black Americans are not achieving a great deal of excellence, and they're not being recognized for the excellence that they're achieving. You take a person like W.E.B. Du Bois, a great black intellectual. His name is hardly even mentioned in the New York Times. There was more written in newspapers about Joe Louis in the 1930s than there was about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so here is a person that is a champion. There is nobody better. Joe Louis says to African Americans, you can excel. You can be the absolute best, the best in the world at something.
Louis managed to become the antithesis of Jack Johnson, or at least he was presented to the public that way. He was presented as a happily married man who had nothing to do with white women, which, of course, was part of Jack Johnson's downfall. Yet Louis was unfaithful to his wife. He was an equal opportunity philanderer by all measures. How was it that the illusion of the champ as a clean-cut All-American was maintained?
You know, sports writers in the 1930s and 1940s, they weren't looking to bring down the idols of sports. They were looking to build them up. I mean, this is the age of Grantland Rice, of the Four Horsemen, of, you know, baseball sports writers. They traveled with a team. They ate free lunches. You know, they weren't going to bite the hand that fed them. It won't be until the 1960s that we'll have this new age of sports writers that are interested in bringing down the heroes.
Joe Louis lost to Max Schmeling in 1936. This was not a championship fight. Why did it become such a big deal?
Joe Louis in 1935, in 1936, he fought a succession of ex-heavyweight champions. He fought Primo Carnera. He fought Max Baer. And now he's fighting Max Schmeling, 1936. It was considered it was going to be another easy fight. Max Schmeling comes over, he knocks Joe Louis out, and now suddenly Max Schmeling is embraced by the Nazi regime in Germany. He has lunch with Adolf Hitler, he has tea with Hitler, he watches the Louis Schmeling fight films with Hitler, and Hitler's slapping on himself on his thigh. And so suddenly now this fight, as America and the world is catapulting towards war, this fight takes on real symbolic baggage.
You include in your biography the famous story about the prisoner being executed in the gas chamber who, with his dying breath, shouted, "Save me, Joe Louis." Is that story true, or does it even matter whether it's true or not?
It's probably not true. It was reported by Martin Luther King in a book that Martin Luther King wrote. But it doesn't matter. The symbolic importance is what matters, is the idea that Joe Louis was viewed in the 1930s for African Americans as a savior. Every day he would receive letters from people asking for this or that. They needed money for an operation. They needed money to keep their apartment or house they were living in. Each letter was an echo of, save me, Joe Louis, save me, Joe Louis.
Speaking of the requests that he received, he was a generous guy.
Oh, he was overly generous. Joe Louis just frittered money away, gave money away. There's a great story told towards the end of Louis's life. He was a greeter in Vegas, and he was talking with Billy Conn, a great Pittsburgh fighter who he had fought. They had a fantastic fight. And anyway, a guy comes up, panhandles Joe Louis, and Joe Louis has some green chips and black chips. Green chips were worth like $25. Black chips were worth $100. Joe Louis gives the guy a handful of black chips. And Billy Conn says, Joe, what are you doing? You're being a schmuck. That guy was panhandling you. And Louis says, yeah, I know. I was just going to lose it anyway. You know, that's the way Louis treated money. In his prime, he would leave his house in the morning. He might have $300-$400 in his pocket. By noon, he'd be broke.
During the Second World War, Joe Louis, who was already way behind on his taxes, donated purses to the war effort, essentially fought for free. Did his willingness to do that have any impact on his debt to the IRS?
None. Here's this guy, he risks his title twice, once in 1941, once in early 1942, and then he donates all the money to the government, but the government says, look, you know, you owe the tax man. It's like that Beatles song about the tax man. You owe the tax man, and if you don't pay it back, we're charging you interest, we're charging you whatever we can charge you.
Much has been written about Joe Louis's last years when he began using drugs, survived on the charity of casino owners in Las Vegas, and endured terrifying episodes of paranoia as well. Did you make a conscious choice to limit your consideration of Joe Louis's last decade or so?
Yes, I did. I was interested in Joe Louis in his prime. I was interested in Joe Louis when he meant so much to so many Americans. I didn't want to dwell on the Joe Louis after he retired, the Joe Louis that had the drug problems. I talk about his drug problems, but I don't think there's any need to belabor the point. I don't think Joe Louis, though, at the end, when he was a greeter in Vegas, he never felt sad for himself. You know, he thought being a greeter was a great job. He played golf every day, and he loved playing golf. He had his place to stay on the Caesars grounds. He would gamble with people. He loved talking with people. He was a gregarious guy. And so I don't view the end of Joe Louis's life as particularly sad.
Is it fair to say, regarding those last few years, that he was just very badly served by a country that he had served rather well?
I think so. Suddenly, a new type of black athlete was emerging. You know, proud, defiant, articulate. You know, a person like Jim Brown in football or Muhammad Ali. Joe Louis wasn't that type of an athlete. So it's as if America forgot about him. There's a one great story that Bob Lipsyte told me, and it was right before the Sonny Liston Muhammad Ali fight. And everybody was talking with Muhammad Ali, and all of a sudden Joe Louis came in. And all the old reporters, the Red Smiths, the famous old reporters, go over to Louis. And afterwards, Lipsyte rounded up one of the reporters and he said, you know, why are you going with that old man? The story is right here. It's Cassius Clay at that time. This is the story. And the reporter looked at Lipsyte and said, oh, you should have seen him when. The world passed Louis by, but the memory lived on.
Randy Roberts is the author of Joe Louis, published by Yale University Press. He joined me from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Randy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it. I enjoy it.
The nation, the story, let us talk about the brown bomber. Well, Joe Louis was a fighting man.
Well, there's Canaris smelling an old bear.
Just like the Battle of Jericho.
John Henry Luce, Jack Dempsey was there.
Way down in Jericho.
He fought Max Smelling the second time.
Just like the Battle of Jericho.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Paul Vikas, Josie Huang, Chris Ballman, Jeremy Bernfeld, and from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Susan Vallett's Rose Bowl photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived chosen stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Maine basketball fan Ryan Garrity, who says he's rooting for Antoine Walker's return to the NBA as long as it isn't with Boston.
No, probably not on the Celtics. I liked him when he was a little younger and didn't shoot as much.
Gee, I remember Walker when he was younger, but when he didn't shoot so much? Nah. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Way down in Jericho, old Peter, Moses, James, and John.
Like the Battle of Jericho.
Josh, you bit the battle, and the battle was won.
Way down in Jericho.
Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation the story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.